a week from today, about this time, we will be preparing to do the Passover. For those of you who have never experienced Passover, from the rabbinical position with regard to the Talmud, the Zohar, all of the ancient documents, the Passover is the single most important event that can occur in time and space. The reason is because it's the beginning of Israel. Prior to Passover, there was no Israel.
Wow.
There was only a bunch of people sort of hanging around in Egypt.
That would describe us.
And God, in the time appointed of the Father, when the sin of the Amorite has been completed, that means when all of your crap has taken itself to the limit, and you see the vanity of your own idolatry, of your own opinions, your own ideas, but more than that, you see the vanity of the world and its ideas and its opinions, because the plagues have come, and you say, I don't like this anymore. And you say, I don't like this anymore, with a new way. Everybody says, I don't like this anymore, 50,000 times in their life. But only on Passover do you say, I don't like this anymore, and I'm not going to give it any more importance, and I'm not going to go lean on my own arm of understanding ever again. I'm not going to try to figure what the hell I'm supposed to do, because every time I figure it out, it all turns to shit anyway. I am going to say, God, if you exist, then here's my life.
Amen.
Without condition. Now, some of you have said, all of you have said one way or another, God, here's my life. But you've said, God, here's my life, and here are the conditions. Now, you didn't have enough guts to say that, but in your response to the stimuli that occurred after you said that, Father, here's my life, you, in effect, said in the Spirit that, God, here's my life, and these are the conditions. You placed yourself above God. You've been God's counselor. It's not smart to be God's counselor. So the Passover celebration is the celebration of the leaving of that mindset. Forever. The dominant theme of Passover, even if I don't have a smile on my face at this moment, three things: total deliverance, total joy, total freedom, beyond anything you've ever imagined before. Now, because we, as in the days of Josiah and Hezekiah, we've torn down the high places. Well, some of them, they were pretty rough high places. I mean, we're talking major battles.
High rises.
But God won, because the weapons of our warfare were not carnal. And we've torn down the groves. We've torn down the false places of worship. At least now, you don't have an excuse to worship your idols anymore, and that's a biggie.
Yeah.
Now, when that happened in the flesh to Israel, they had a Passover like none that was ever holden before or after. I'm here to tell you, we're going to have a Passover that made theirs look like kindergarten. Because they only had the Passover with regard to escape, deliverance, and freedom from temporal things, from flesh stuff. We have a Passover freedom from our mind, from the deliverance of cause and effect. Plus the fact that this is the first time that we are a body. Now, you can't be a body in Egypt.
Oh.
What?
Oh, no. That left an impression on me.
You like that?
What we're going to do from now, the times, we meet what? Monday, Wednesday.
Monday, Wednesday, Saturday.
But we're not going to meet Saturday. So we'll meet Monday, Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So Monday and Wednesday, we will study in detail some neat stuff in the New Testament that you'll never understand in a million years unless you know Christ was talking about Passover. Okay? The other thing you have to, I hope, that's become meat to you is that nothing that we talk about is optional. Understand? None of you still think it's optional, right?
It's an improvement. But it's like optional.
I love it.
Now, on the 10th of Nisan, which is the Jewish first of the Jewish months, they are instructed to select the lamb, analyze, inspect the lamb. And so, you know, it's more than the 10th, but you got to select the lamb right now. That's what you're going to do today. You're going to take and you're going to select the lamb. And you're going to look. You're going to analyze. And you're going to see if that lamb has any spots or wrinkles in it. If there's any part of that lamb that can't satisfy every need, spiritual, soul, and physical, then don't take the Passover. If there's anything that you feel that the power of God is not sufficient to overcome in your life, then you can't take the Passover. Let me put it another way. If there's anything that you think the power, that you hope the power of God can overcome, you can't take the Passover.
Say that again.
I don't get that. Say that again.
It didn't come out quite the way that. Maybe it did.
There's three kinds of leaven that will be excised during the next few days, and then when we get up there. And I've talked to you about it. The leaven of the Sadducees, the leaven of Herod, and the leaven of the Pharisees. Now God is searching out Jerusalem, or the New Jerusalem, with a candle, it says in Zechariah, and he's finding the leaven. And he's doing it by his Spirit. Things will be brought to your mind. Passover, up the point leading up to Passover is usually really dumb, because the things you don't want to hear. You don't want to hear somebody come up to you and say, can I talk to you a minute? So anyway, we're gonna inspect the lamb. And that's what you do when you sit down and look and see and forget scriptures for a minute. They didn't have any scriptures. You understand? I mean, they just had instinct and gut and honesty. Abraham didn't have any scriptures. And so it's time to open yourselves up maybe in a level, even in honesty, that you've never even done before, even greater than you've done at Groves or High Places, to yourself at least, to see if there's any place that you doubt the power of God. That's the leaven of Sadducees. See if there's any place that you still see lack or see need. That's the leaven of Herod. And see if there's any place or anything that you're still hiding from the brethren. That's the leaven of the Pharisees. Okay? Now the Jews had a tradition. Jesus came into Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan. And everybody, that's the 4 days when they were supposed to analyze the land. Everybody said, praise God, hallelujah, the Messiah's come, hooray. And they threw their cloaks down and they did palm branch things and hosannaed him. But he was riding on the colt of an ass. And so the leadership knew, according to prophecy, that if Messiah came in the clouds, he was happy. If Messiah came riding on the colt of an ass, he's pissed off. And when the high priest Caiaphas said what he did about Christ during those 4 days, he knew who Christ was. And they killed him anyway.
And what was his name, Caiaphas?
Caiaphas. He was the high priest.
Was there repentance in Caiaphas?
No.
Caiaphas didn't do it out of knowledge?
He did it out of pure knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Pure knowledge of the flesh.
Oh, okay. Okay.
To save the people of Israel. Is what he said.
He's afraid.
What that about him riding on an ass, was that in the Old Testament or the Talmud or whatever?
Well, it's Zechariah. It's in Daniel. It's alluded to in Daniel, but it's in Zechariah 9. Now, Jesus celebrated in the scriptures three different Passovers. The first one he celebrated with his natural family, his mother, if Joseph was still alive, with Joseph, probably with Joseph of Arimathea, his uncle, James, his brother, the people that were blood kin. The first Passover he had celebrated with a blood kin. Second Passover he celebrated with a blood kin. The first Passover, prior to the Passover, immediately prior to the Passover, he took a whip, a score of ropes, the first one, and he went running through the temple and overturned those who were playing in the game of cause and effect. He overthrew the tables of the money changers in the temple. And he said, you have made my father's house a den of thieves. You are the house of God. You are the temple of God. And Jesus, over the next few days, is going through that temple by his Spirit with a scourge, with a whip, overturning every place in your life where you have made the temple of God into a Canaanite temple, the merchants, the cause and effect belief. Understand? He did that the first Passover after he was baptized, and he did it again the third Passover before he was crucified. He turned over, and this time he really got mad. You understand the symbolism? You are now the temple of God. That's a picture of you. Okay? Now, it was the astonishment and indignation of those who would intensely resent his interference with their authority and gain.
One more time.
Jesus was a threat in the temple, and he was perceived in the temple as he was doing this. They intensely resented his interference with their authority. Mm-hmm. And they intensely resented his interference with their potential for gain. Mm-hmm. Same thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I want you to think of your highest and best hope about anything. History has proven that even if you did achieve your highest and best hope in the past, it turned to nothing as you achieved it. Now God is coming along and he's making you a promise. He's saying to you, your highest and best hope will be achieved with absolutely no effort on your part. If you want to continue being a money changer, or the i.e. cause and effect, impulse, response, reward, punishment, he's not going to fight your efforts. Do you understand that? Sit back, please, Paul. I mean, can you imagine? Okay, God sees this. He said, okay, you sit and you say, Father, this is what my heart's desire. You mean it. And 3 minutes later, when you forgot the prayer, you immediately sat down and began to calculate how to get your heart's desire. The minute you do that, you have placed a cover, literally, a steel lead, if you will, cover between you and the Father. That's why it says, they that wait on the Lord is equivalent to love. Now, Passover is the celebration when God is going to prove to you that even as you celebrate the Passover and the Egyptians are coming after you, and you're confronted and you get up to that impossible situation where the Red Sea is in front of you, two mountains on either side of you, the Egyptian army behind you, and you'll hear a whisper in your ear. You want to hire a helicopter real quick. And God says to you, stand still and see the salvation of God. And then, when they were saved, then they believed. Believe is always, you've heard me talk about that 100,000 times, but believing is with believing and knowledge, or faith and knowledge are exactly synonymous. It's not blind. You know, they believed, they had faith after they were saved.
Amen. You can't believe what you don't see.
You understand that?
Yeah.
Now, do you have the guts to make to let it happen?
I know what you mean.
All right. Now.
That's exactly the opposite of faith, is the evidence of things not seen.
What?
Is it not? It's not.
Of course not. Faith is the evidence. What do you think evidence is?
Something that's substantially
proves
something.
Right. What do you, let's stop a minute. What is faith to you?
Surrendering to God's power.
Where did you get that idea?
It just always seemed like that's what it was. I don't know.
Do you ever think about faith? Passover, Israel had absolutely no faith before the Passover. You understand?
All they had was fear.
All they had was the fear of God.
I like your chair analogy.
I understand.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. You're sitting down in that chair.
Yeah.
Why? That's a dumb thing to do. That thing could fall over and you'd break your back in 2 seconds.
It doesn't look like it will, though.
But why not?
because
you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of stimuli in your mind, in that hunk of protoplasm, that caused you to know that it was worth the risk for you to defy gravity and place your behind in something that you don't haven't calculated as to whether or not it can actually hold you. The evidence from years of experience caused the faith. You understand? Faith, you can't have, I mean, that's a simplistic thing. I mean, that's, when you first start out, obviously the first impulse that you take vis-a-vis your position with God, it's, you kind of hope it. Right? I mean,
yeah,
oh my God,
look at the chair.
You know, no, I mean, forget the chair a minute. I'm talking about not something that you haven't had that experience with before. Your first experience with God is based on desperation.
Well, that's for sure. That was the word I was hearing. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Okay. Now, somehow, in desperation, something happened. Right? Either you forgot about the desperation, or the desperation was turned to hope, or the desperation was turned to something else that caused you to continue to the next step. Because if it wasn't, you'd be dead. Because the natural outcome of desperation is suicide. If desperation is not carried out, or how do you pronounce that word? Assuaged? Is that good? That sounds dumb. If it's
accommodated.
Right. If desperation is not accommodated. I can't say assuaged with a straight face. I can't say that one either. If desperation is not accommodated, you will commit suicide physically. With a gun, with pills.
With a knife in your heart.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With a real dumb way, you'll take a knife and try to find your heart.
Oops, that was wrong. Wait a minute. Huh? Never mind.
Do you understand what I'm saying? So somehow, at that point of desperation, you hoped that God would do something, and he did, whether or not you recognized it or could I quantify it or not. It had nothing to do with the Bible. It had nothing to do with somebody preaching to you. It had nothing to do. It was a private experience. If your faith is based on me preaching to you, you're in deep shit. Because it won't last. You know, it's like I told you before when we were doing the hot seat stuff. If your persona vis-a-vis the Father is based on memorized doctrine, then when you stand before the judgment seat, you'll forget everything you ever memorized. You'll just stand there scared shitless. And you'll do exactly what Harry did in the hot seat. What?
Names are not.
It's necessary.
You mean justify yourself?
You'll do exactly what Harry did. You'll say, I was a pretty good guy. You know, if I hung around long enough, I thought that, you know, and I did all this nice stuff. And God will say to you, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I mean, with the talk of you going overseas, first broke, you know, I guess it was a couple of years ago or something, with the possibility of you going back over there first arose again. And it freaked me out really bad. But the last time, you know, just recently that it was a possibility or an eventuality that you would go over there, I wasn't near as alarmed because I thought, you know, if God can't cover our, you know, cover us in the absence of Oli, then we're dead meat now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, the idea that, do you know how distasteful memorized stuff is?
Yeah, I had an experience with that the other night.
I mean, when you try to... Have you ever had one of these idiots come up to you and talk to you about God and all they've done is memorize something?
Nothing
from heart. It's really funny when two of them do it.
Oh, yeah, like the Mormons come and double-team you.
It's like getting a whore.
I mean, there's something that your persona, the only one that will attract is another whore. You understand that, my spirit? If your basis of your life in terms of and your experience of spirituality is based on what I have told you, or based on memorized stuff out of here, you're a whore. And your fear toward God is taught by the precepts of men. You don't want to do that. That's not smart. Now, where we want to be, and this is one of the things this Passover homily talks about. By the way, I'm sorry, I got sidetracked. The Passover homily, it was given, the recorded version of it we have, was given in A.D. 150. That's 1840 approximately years ago. Their understanding, as you will see when this is read, was so mind-blowing that you cannot believe it. I mean, it's like they knew that our only function was to be permanently residing in the New Jerusalem, not the Jerusalem below. Now, there's Psalms 120 to 134 that we will go through up there. They're the Psalms of Ascent. They were not allowed to be, well, that's not true. There's some, the earlier ones are like when you're outside, you're out of the land. You know, you're back in the wilderness, you're in Egypt or somewhere. And then as you get closer and closer to Jerusalem, the intensity of the psalm increases until you know that you're permanently residing in the New Jerusalem. And that's what we hope to be able to share with all of the groups together Saturday. Okay? Now, I want each of you to study those psalms between now and then, to read them, to become familiar with them. All right? Now, let's talk about why celebrate Passover, basically, some basic stuff. You know, Jesus and his disciples had to walk 75 miles to do it. And when they did it, there was a virtual price on his head. And we're going to drive to 75 miles. We're not going to walk, though. Maybe Harry should walk.
On my knees, while flagellating myself.
Bishop, in reciting the rosary.
Hail Mary.
Now, Paul said in 1 Corinthians, which was written, what, AD 70 or something like that? Just before, AD 60, 65. He said, "Purge out therefore the leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." The only sincerity that has any merit in this Passover is Christ's, as you most of you know by now anyway. Now, the ceremony is really neat, because as with hopefully everything else we study, your senses experience the phenomenon, for those of you who haven't done it. And so when you're talking about the bitterness and the crap that goes on in the world, You eat this rotten stuff, but you know.
Clears out your senses.
Oh yeah, clears out your toenails if we can find the right stuff.
What?
Let's go to John. Everybody have a Bible?
No.
Go to John 11. We're going to try to go through John 11 through John 21.
That's a long way.
No. Through John 20, verse 10. It's a long way. All of that is about Passover. And you won't understand any of that unless you understand Passover. Read, somebody.
I'll read. Where?
Starting John 11.
All right. Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment, and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, The sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha, and her sister, and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Then after that saith he to his disciples, Let us go into Judea again. His disciples say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee. Goest thou thither again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. These things said he, and after that he saith unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go, that I may awake him out of sleep.
Okay. This is the way the world looked in terms of the time of Christ. Christ spent almost his entire time in Galilee, which is the yellow part. Okay? The Jews were forbidden to go from Galilee through Samaria. Samaria was an unclean land. The reason is because the Samaritans built their own temple, had their own temple sacrifices, and became an anathema to the Jews. They wouldn't even talk to them. I mean, you were unclean if you even looked at one crosswise. So normally, the Jews that were in Galilee, this is called, by the way, the place where Christ was from, Galilee, is all this yellow area. And the Jews that lived in Judea thought it was unclean. Remember, they always kept anybody from Galilee as a bum, and everybody from Galilee, you know, what prophet could there be from Galilee? And, you know, there's only, in all of the Talmud, you know, the Talmud has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rabbis. I told you this. There's only one rabbi from Galilee. Rabbi
Jose.
But it's called, they called it the Galilee of the Nations. And the reason is because they were so intermingled here with people from Syria, people from the Lebanon, the Canaanites. Everybody was sort of mingled around here. And they didn't have a separate identity within Galilee as Jews. I mean, just, they were sort of like us. We sort of hang around and do stuff.
It's like East Dallas.
Yeah, it's like East Dallas. And so Jesus spent most of his time in Galilee. Now, by the end of the third year, which is what we're just now approaching, when he's going to be crucified in a week, as it said, there's a price on his head in Judea. Judea is the only part of the original promise land . This was all the tribes, right? Okay. All these guys, except for Judah and Benjamin, all of these tribes, even this one down here, got sent off because they built groves in the holy place.
When was that?
In 721 B.C. What? 721 B.C.
Is it in the Bible?
Oh, yeah, it's in Kings, 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, yeah. Okay, so they got all sent off in slavery up to Babylon. And so the only two tribes that exist at the time of Christ and for hundreds of years before then were the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Judah. The rest of the other 10 tribes were dispersed throughout the world and mixed with all the other peoples. The reason that God saved those two tribes is a very important one. One is Benjamin. Wait a minute. Damn it. Benjamin, Jerusalem, is in the tribe of Benjamin. Right there. And the function of Benjamin and the tribe of Benjamin was to be the keepers of the temple. They were the ones that kept and were responsible for the temple. The function of Judah, from a spiritual standpoint, was to be the keeper of the bloodline, to keep the line pure all the way back to the earliest history, to keep that bloodline pure, just like you were breeding cattle and you wanted to keep it pure. That's from God's standpoint, that was the purpose. And then the purpose of keeping the bloodline pure was that pureness had to be extant in the mother of the Messiah. You understand? That's the only reason the Jews existed. First, to have the temple to show us the picture of us. And second, to keep the bloodline pure in the tribe of Judah. And they were called, because of that, the oracle people. You understand? So now, at the time of Christ, everything's all screwed up. Lines are drawn, lands are different, totally different. And so when Jews came from all the way up here in Babylon or Assyria or Persia, they came down the traditional trading routes and followed this, but they could not go into Samaria. They had to come down here and follow at this valley and come into Bethany and then across to Jericho. Now, Mary and these guys, they lived at, see, there's two Bethanies, this Bethany here that's in Perea, and this Bethany here that's right next to Jerusalem. You see the difference? Well, like, this Bethany is like 3 miles. It's like, you know, it's from Highland Park to University Park. That's, and it's a suburb of Jerusalem, but it was a very wealthy suburb. Now, Magdala was another suburb of Jerusalem, except Magdala was the red light district. So now here we have a situation. This Mary, the Mary in verse 1, now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. I can show you, and we'll do it later, I'm not going to do it now, that Mary was Mary Magdala. Magdala was not her last name. She, Magdala, was the red light district of Jerusalem. It was, so when someone was called Mary of Magdala, it meant Mary the whore, the prostitute. But the problem was that she was a relative of Jesus. She was Jesus' cousin. Lazarus was also his cousin. The evidence is overwhelming. Now, that's why he said, in this case, he loved. There's only a few people in all of the Bible that said Jesus loved. It was Lazarus, Martha, Mary, and the Apostle John. As far as I know, that's the only four. And the rich young ruler, 5, excuse me. And he uses a particular word there for love. There are 5 Greek words that are translated love, and we all jump them up and make them one big lure, and we try to get confused about it. But the word here that he says when he loves, it meant that he was good buddies with. He was friends. He was close friend. The other word normally that's used for love is agape. That's what all the spiritual stuff about love your brethren and all that. It has nothing to do. Jesus probably didn't even like most of the people. But he loved them. It's a totally different thing. All right? So now, Christ, all this time, from the time he's 12 years old until now, has had to make this trip 3 times a year. They had to, all males that were 12 years old and over had to present themselves at the appointed place of God for the three pilgrimage feasts. They had to come before Passover, they had come at Tabernacles, and they had come at the Feast of Pentecost. And so they made this trip. Here's Nazareth, that's where he's from, so here he goes. Every year, they make this trip through Jericho into Jerusalem. It's a common trip. Never go through here. Well, now he fakes him out. He shows that nothing is unclean in the flesh, and he walks right through the middle of Samaria.
Wow.
Neat stuff. There's another picture here. That's a picture of you. This is the Dead Sea. It's the lowest place on the face of the earth. It's 1,292 feet below the Mediterranean Sea. Sodom and Gomorrah were right here, at the point, the bottom of this, in this sort of little dealy right here. Prior to the explosion which destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, the Jordan River is here. It started up here in the high mountains of Lebanon, which have snow on them all year round. The scriptures say that at the time of Abraham, this valley coming down from up in Lebanon through the valley down through to the Gulf of Aqaba was the most beautiful place in the face of the earth, is what it says in Abraham. It says it was equivalent to the Garden of Eden. Now, when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed as the type, they were physically, I mean, now they found out, they know exactly what happened because of particular chemical structures that exist here, that if a lightning bolt hit at the exact right time, that this whole area here was like a minor atomic bomb. It just blew the snot out of everything. And it caused a depression that's 1,292 feet below sea level. So that now all the mineral salts and everything that flows up from Lebanon, where the water's pure, is dammed. And as the water evaporates, the minerals and the salts just keep increasing and increasing and increasing until there's no life. It's the most desolate place on the face of the earth.
The Dead Sea.
The Dead Sea and the area around it. Nothing can live there.
There's not a single living thing in that
Nothing.
Body of water?
No, hell no.
They mine the lake, they mine the water chemicals.
Now, all of this down here used to be the most beautiful place, continuance of it. Now it's total and complete desert. In the same way, Babylon, God did something sneaky to Babylon. The Tigris and Euphrates River that come down out of Russia and through all that high mountains, flowed down and flowed down to the Persian Gulf. It too was mind-blowingly beautiful, not by biblical history alone, but by all of the archaeological documents. When Babylon was destroyed, God changed the course of the Tigris and Euphrates River. When that happened, then all that beauty became a total and complete desert. And that's what, you know, the same thing is here. Now the point of all this is that this is a picture of you. When you dam up and judge for yourself good and evil, when you don't prophesy and just let out what's there and that great feeling as the little child just running around doing stuff, then you, in effect, dam up the river of life, which the Jordan symbolizes, and you become as the Dead Sea. You understand? Now, in that picture of Christ walking through that, when he's a whole lot brighter than I am, and he's got 10 billion, jillion, sextabillion times as much revelation. Every time he walked through this desert in the Dead Sea area to come into Jerusalem, he saw exactly what had happened to man and what had happened to those around him. That's why, and Paul understood it, that's why he says, except for the seed, we would have been made as like Gomorrah and made like Sodom and made like unto Gomorrah. Understand? So in Christ's eye view and in your view of Passover, from another kind of neat thing that happens just because of the trek you follow, what you're doing in Passover is you're taking and blowing up the last vestiges of the dam that has been damming the Dead Sea. And you'll have this thing that's spoken of in Amos. The Lord has spoken. Who can but prophesy? You no longer have the right to judge your own thoughts, your own speaking. You are only to bubble forth, is what prophecy means. You understand? And as Christ went over this trek day after day, and while they were doing that, while they were going down here, they're singing the Psalms of Ascent. And the Psalms of Ascent are always and ever your movement towards Jerusalem. Now, for us now, it's the new Jerusalem, the overriding reality that exists wherever we are. Wherever our feet touch is the holy place, in the same way that it was with Abraham, because we can see through the veil of the flesh, and we will celebrate Passover in the new Jerusalem, as it talks about in Ezekiel. You understand? Now, I said all that to say this. Christ was somewhere probably in this area here when Lazarus died.
So at this point, is this the trip that he went through?
Right. He's making his way to the final Passover.
It just occurred to me that he's got these 12 tag-alongs here who don't want to go through Samaria.
Oh, no. We're talking... We're talking really... These 12 guys... These 12 guys make you look like saints.
I mean, they just...
Look what he's doing
now.
Oh, my God.
Want to do that.
Yeah. Well, no,
they don't. They don't like any of this. I mean, all he's done for 3 years is get him in trouble. Now he's going to get him in trouble more than they ever dreamed about, because every year up until then, Matthew and, you know, all these guys, they've been having their Passover with their family. Right?
Oh, wow. I mean, the first 2 years that they were with Christ?
Yeah, they separated here. They just thought he was another, like, teacher guy, right?
Excuse me, I have to go home.
Go home and have Christmas.
I have to go and have Passover with...
I hear my mother calling.
Yeah, my mother's calling. I'm serious. We're talking biggie.
And their parents probably didn't like Jesus anyway.
Parents didn't like Jesus.
Ah, that's hilarious.
In fact, in-laws
didn't either.
In fact, I told you before, and I'll show you, and we've talked about it, that Jesus' own parents thought he was crazy.
He was beside himself. Mm-hmm.
And Jesus not only said all that, he said, you dummies, if they've done that to me, why are you surprised if they do it to you? Why do you think it's strange they've even called me Beelzebub, the devil? Why do you think it's strange if they say silly things about you? But all this is now going to culminate in this Passover. You've got 12 disciples, including Judas. Judas is the oldest. Judas is about 30. Most of his disciples are teenagers. In fact, John is probably at this point in the third year. He started following Christ when he was bar mitzvahed, which would have been either 12 or 13 at the time. So now the most John is 16. Mark, who one of these books is called after, family was wealthy, and they ate Passover in the upstairs of Mark's family. And Mark's up there and sort of sneaking around watching. He's interested. You know, he's about 9 or 10. And he's listening at the door and everything. And so then when Christ, after Passover, goes out into the Garden of Gethsemane, Mark is following him. It says it in here. Mark's following him just because he's fascinated with these crazy guys. And then he sees Judas come over and kiss Christ. He sees Peter, and then that's the symbol that the Roman guards were to take him. Peter takes out his sword, cuts off the ear. Christ healed the guy's ear. Then these Roman guards and the temple guards see this kid, Mark. Mark takes off running. One of the guards grabs his cloak, and Mark runs through his cloak and is running naked from Gethsemane back to his house. This is one of the heroes. This is Saint Mark.
The famous midnight run.
You got it? So quit getting down on yourselves for not meeting some stupid image of what you think you should be. You got a little feel of this? Every one of the disciples, Peter denied him three times, every one of the disciples ran away.
And they fell asleep when he didn't want them to.
Oh yeah, they fell asleep twice. They were drunk. They just celebrated Passover. They had four huge cups of wine.
Homemade wine.
Strong wine. We're not talking list 3.2 stuff.
Homemade.
Yeah. Okay. You got all this now? You getting the feel for what's going on at Passover? Now this time Christ has now told them. No, he doesn't tell them yet. He tells them a little bit. He's got to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why? Why does he raise Lazarus from the dead 4 or 5 days before Passover? 6 days.
Prove his power?
So he knows he could show that he could have raised himself.
To show that he could have raised himself. Now, that power which he knows is resident within him is going to be denied. And he places himself totally in the hands of the Father.
It's like he had a hand in his own test.
Every one of them were. That's every purpose. Everything that Christ ever did was not to benefit the people. People were benefited, but that wasn't the purpose. The reason he did it was so that the power that was resident within him could be tested, but he had to know he had the power before he could be given up. I've told you before, in a very simplistic way, it's no big thing if I deny or give up, you know, being quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. That's, yeah. But it's a big thing for me if I give up at every juncture since I've been a believer the propensity to make money. I can't lean on my own arm of understanding. That's the biggie for me. Now, each of you have different biggies. Because God in his grace is, you know, filling. Yeah, each one of you have a different type of deal. And it's not like, oh, I'm so sorry I'm giving this up. That's set. That God doesn't like that kind of stuff. Believe me.
Can't miss it when it's gone.
Right. Right. Okay? So now he's about to tell his disciples. In fact, they're all walking together in the... They're about to separate and go, each one of them, to their own families to celebrate Passover as they'd done every year since they were 12 years old. And Christ said, no. He picked out two of them and he said, you two go ahead and prepare a place for us to have Passover. Disciples were blown away.
There you go.
Look what the fuck he's done to us now. Doesn't he know what this is going to do? My mother's going to kill me.
Aren't they like disowned and dead if they, you don't have Passover with the family?
It's a definition of who your family is.
Think about their Jewish mothers too.
Huh?
They had Jewish mothers too.
Well, yeah, but again...
Look what he's doing now.
No, but again, the mothers... Again, remember, all of these festivals... forget what modern Jewry does. It was only the males that ate the Passover.
Wow.
It was only the males that went on the trip. It was only the males that had the law. Why? Not as a deal that's anti-feminist, but as a deal to show you that once you become a believer, you're free. You're under the covering of he who has fulfilled all the law. And just as if you were in a perfect marriage and the wife and the husband was ultimate rich and big time powerful and had everything in the world, and his wife was under his covering, not that she couldn't fulfill herself and express herself and push her desires to every moment, but so that she was no longer subject for her to make a living. She was no longer subject for her to be concerned about who's going to pay the rent. She was no longer subject to her about what to do this and how to do that and when to do it. He, the husband, our husband, Christ, is now responsible for all of those activities. Do you understand? We're talking about revolutionary concepts, not feminist or anti-feminist. And now, for you, this year, as a body, will be the first time, whether or not you've ever celebrated Passover with your family or not, this is the definition of your family. In the same way that it was with Christ. In the same way that it was with the disciples. Can you understand that?
Shit's new life.
But do you understand what it did to the disciples when it happened? That's what I want you to emotionalize. Blew them away when he said, you know what he said to them? He said, God, if you only knew how long I have longed to eat this Passover with you. He'd been longing to do it since the beginning of time. And now in the time appointed of the Father, the feast and its meaning is fulfilled. And now in you, the same way, how long has he longed to eat this Passover with you? Same exact feeling, same exact message, same exact sensation. You have been wandering, you have been seeking your own, you have been doing all of the things based on the one single lie of your life. From your birth, your mind, your surroundings, and everything in you told you that you were separate. You had to prove yourselves. You had to become good at this, or shouldn't do that, or should do this, and this is the things I have to do. Now, the real meaning of Passover is that you recognize who your Father is. You recognize the freedom and the deliverance from the lie of separation from this point and forevermore. And that's the one lie by which the whole world lieth in deception. You've got to do something. And that's the lie that'll get you. That's the lie that will cause your high place identity to resurrect itself. Every time you think there's something that you must do, then it will be manifested in you, and some of you in fear, and some of you in confusion, and some of you in different ways. But it's always the lie returning, just like the snake is all over the stars and the signs of the zodiac. He's trying to resurrect himself. Now, again, I'll say it. Christ is saying to you, he's saying to you, just as he did to them, now you go and prepare a place that we might eat the Passover. And now he's saying to you, how long I have desired to eat this Passover with you. Amen?
Amen.
Okay. Now, we didn't study anything I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we did, sort of.
Does this sound familiar?
Yeah,
that's
very good.
Okay,
September, and you say.
Yeah, you're
cute.
Time to go eat.
In verse 7, then after that saith he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples said unto him, Master, the Jews. And see, again, Jew, you all know where the word Jew comes from?
Judea.
Huh?
Judea.
Judah. To their viewpoint, the Jews are the ones that were in Judea. They're Galileans. Now, Paul now comes along and he defines it totally and completely different. He said a Jew now no longer is somebody that has circumcision of the flesh or is born of Judea or is any of that crap. Now a Jew is one whose circumcision is of the heart. All right, so the Jews are going to kill him. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. Now, in a way, that's I need to targum that for you, because it says something really neat. It says, we each have our working time, or day, or our purpose from God. And while it lasts, no foe on the face of the earth, no spirit, nothing can shorten it or break it up. However, if a man walk in his own way and at his own time, he stumbleth, because the light is not in him. You understand?
So basically you're saying,
once,
I gotta go do this.
Yeah, but he's saying nothing can stop him. Nothing can come in the way until the time appointed of the Father. That's what you must begin to see in terms of a sense of destiny. Nothing can prevent.
He's saying, I'm doing
that's
this
the same
one.
As somebody said to the Sanhedrin. Yeah. Somebody said, if this is of God, then stop it. And if it
Gamaliel
isn't, then
said
why
it.
Worry about it?
Yeah.
Same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the sun rises and I'm doing this.
Now. And then in verse 11 it says, then you know, and then Jesus said, the famous one that they put all over, the night cometh when no man can work. You know, it's up here in the Baptist church sign on that clock.
Park City Baptist.
Guess what, folks? The night came at the cross. No man has been able to work since the cross.
It only looks like the darkness looks at the three in the
afternoon. Yeah. Okay, verse 12. Then said his disciples, 11, excuse me. These things said he, and after that he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may wake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well.
You can just see him rolling his eyes.
He said, oh, shit. The reason is, in the Jewish tradition, sleep was considered a sign of recovery in serious illness. That's, I mean, all of this is why they said this kind of stuff. Okay, now. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. Howbeit, Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep. Then Jesus said unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead, you dummies.
Lazarus is dead.
And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent you may believe. Now, nevertheless, let us go on to him. That's an incredible thing to say.
I don't get what it means.
Well, he's saying he's glad the disciples
weren't there.
And he wasn't there.
Why?
Because he's going to show them something big time.
He can heal them like all those other times,
yeah.
But this time it's
big time.
Better than
Elijah. Okay.
Thomas.
Nevertheless, then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Now, why in the hell would he say that?
Mm-hmm. Trying to be valiant.
Yes, faith.
Are you
religious? Lazarus was like on the board of directors. It was Lazarus, Joseph of Arimathea. These were the guys that were the behind-the-scenes powers. These were the people that funded. How do you think these guys, they didn't work for 3 years. All they did was sort of walk around and sit in under trees and do God stuff. Well, there was a group of people that gave to so that these disciples could out and do that. Okay? So why then is Peter saying,
Thomas,
he's saying something incredible thing. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us go that we may die with him. Why would he say that?
He thinks it's all over.
He thinks that while by them going into Jerusalem, he knows that Jesus is going to be killed, that their leader, one of their leaders, Lazarus, is dead. They have no source. They have no hope. They have no nothing.
Looks pretty bad. So it's kind of like mission accomplished?
It's done. No, mission's off, baby. Aborted. Finished.
Crashed city.
Crashed. Fail.
It wasn't done on Broadway.
Do you feel it?
Yeah.
I mean, we get this storybook picture of the disciples in this book from all of the crap that we see in the movies. This is, I mean, they thought they were done. What are you doing?
This is what Christ looks like in all the little cathedrals. Is that what it was? I'm serious. You said storybook pictures.
His hair is always nicely combed.
Really, just once I'd like to see a movie where like the disciples are picking their nose and farting.
Like two saddles meets Christ.
You've gone too far. But you get a lot better picture of what was going on for Judas too.
Yeah, that
I
he wasn't the only one.
That
was screwed up.
It could have
been anyone.
But there were four. Everything in the Times for like 40 years now has been to indicate that the desired one, the coma, that his time was. The Median and Persian philosophers from the Avesta, the Zoroasters. Everything was pointing towards that something of universal significance was happening at this time. There were 40, in the 40 or so years from the time, it was 46 years from the time the temple, that Herod built the temple, it took 46 years to build that building. There were 400 men who either they themselves or others said about them that they were Messiah.
Plus, is this a Jubilee year? It was
yeah, mm-hmm. This is the Jubilee year. Yeah. Which is... So, my point to you is that they're saying, oh my God, just another failure. This is just another one of these jokers.
Yeah, not only that, but they cashed in all their chips on a failure.
Oh yeah, well, we'll see in a minute, but what they not only cashed in all their chips, Peter takes seven of them, and says we're gonna return to our former way of life. We're not gonna do this shit anymore.
So part of this thing about I'm glad Lazarus is dead so that you can believe, part of that is I'm gonna die, and you can believe.
And the return of prophets.
You understand that Christ? See, none of we have all these fairy book tales about what the Holy Spirit is, and these guys were failures. Total failures. They couldn't be anything until the Feast of Pentecost, when the power of God was rested upon them.
Even though they had learned a lot of stuff.
They learned a lot of stuff, but they forgot it. You know, that's why they had to go through this process. The disciples had to sit down while they were still living, and it says that in Luke, and in the sight of at least three witnesses, they had to verify the words that are now in the Gospels. That these were actually said. And they had to go through the process. Oh, crap, we're not going to, you know, let's not, I don't want to put that in there. I mean,
that's okay.
Yeah, or I'm not going to, we can't, you know, can you imagine? There are all these Gospels that are extant now that are written by weirdos that were written about Christ during his childhood. And so, can you imagine if it said in here that Christ ate oatmeal? That's why the years of Christ are silent, because there's no role model. And the same thing happens in you. You can't expect a role model. You can't look to me or to anyone. It's him working himself out in your uniqueness. And that's your identity. Not to be patterned or modeled or formed by some idiot like me. It's for him to be express himself in you freely and fully and just bubbling forth. And that's what this feast is about. So you leave Egypt, now he can begin that process in you.
I just get the feeling that somehow, you know, that uniqueness and the fact that we don't have any role model, it just... For some reason, it seems so interconnected with the same with Lazarus.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this is a good place to stop, because I'm getting hungry. As long as Daryl was hungry, it didn't matter.
Oh, yeah, that's a good reason.
God told me to stop.
And the rabbi became angry.
Anybody have any comments, or...
That'll be the day.
Do you have a little bit of understanding about Passover?
Yeah.
Anybody have anything else? Think about this stuff. Read Psalm 120 to 134, that's the Psalms of Ascent. Now, just for a little dealy. These are the Passover scriptures in the Gospels. Okay? It's Matthew 19:1. And if you don't know this Passover ceremony, you'll get them all confused. Okay, it's Matthew 19:1 to Matthew 28:15. That's a whole bunch. Mark 9:30 to 16:13. Luke 17:11 to 24:35. John 11:1 to John 20:25. Now, the earlier, you know, when he's a kid, and the earliest Passovers are John 2:13 to 3:21. This is that last, those ones I gave you were all about the last one, only the third. 2:13 to 3:21. Then a reference in John 6:4. And then Luke 2:41 to 52.
2:41 to 52?
Right. But these, I want you to see how major a deal. I mean, that's a whole bunch of the Bible that we think of as the New Testament. It's all about Passover. Okay? Take it large person.
Where are we going to eat?